It is 9:30 a.m., and this is panel number 4152. And the title of the panel is Democrats, Who Are We Now? Boy, am I interested in this conversation, and I'm not kidding. I once again ask for those who particularly came in late, please turn your phones on to silent. You may want to leave them on. I normally recommend just turning them off and actually paying human attention. But we have a new technology device this year. In this CWA session, we will utilize both the CWA app and a note card system to receive questions from the audience. To ask a question in the app, simply select this session in the schedule, tap Live Q&A, and then insert your question. You may also raise your hand at any time to request a note card and a pencil from one of our producers. Our producers are in the back, so you may have to give a little wave and look in the back. We've got one of our lovely producers right there showing himself very bravely. Then those producers will take the question that you fill out on the card and pass it to me, and I will do my best to assure that every question is answered, but obviously if several people ask the same question, I will consolidate. And we also have limited time. I am one of those people that likes to stay on time, so you will notice that. I also recommend when you write down or submit questions via the application that it is a question, not a statement. I will not be rereading statements. We want to really be an engaged conversation. And to be engaged, you have to ask honest questions when you want actual honest answers. Okay? So that's what we're here to do. And so I'll start by introducing myself. I am the moderator. My name is Lara Lee Hollinghorst. And yes, for those of you in the room that recognize the last name, I am known in this community mostly as Dickie Lee and Bob's daughter. Bob, who was the county treasurer for 12 years, and Dickie Lee, who was the representative of this district, House District 10, and just this January gaveled down as the first Democratic woman to be elected Speaker of the Colorado State House. Go, folks. Go, parents. And I recently have what I will only describe as the privilege and honor of serving as the Boulder County Democratic Chair for 2015 and 2016, which is a very fun year to have done that job. And one of the reasons that this panel was so exciting to me and I'm so privileged to have been asked to do this is my mother was chair of the Boulder County Democratic Party in 1974 to 76. So without giving too much of my age away, let's just say I have been involved in the party since I was about four. I have watched Boulder go from a Republican bastion, yes, it was, yep. For those of you that were here in the 70s, you know this, to one of the most, if not the most, liberal county in the country. I still use the word liberal. We'll talk about that later. But I just want you guys to know that I think that this question is more important now than it has ever been, and I do speak from a place of deep, profound experience and emotional connection to the party of the Democratic Party when I say that. So with that said, it is an absolute honor and a privilege to introduce this incredible panel to facilitate this discussion between themselves and then, of course, including you guys. We have, starting over at the left hand of the table for me, I guess right hand for you guys, we have Marshall Steinbaum, the senior economist, pardon me, and fellow from the Roosevelt Institute. Please hold your applause to the end. We have next to him the amazing Eugene Sepulveda, CEO of Entrepreneurs Foundation and director of Capital Factory, Entrepreneurs Foundation, and again, Capital Factory. Sorry, I'm just reading the bio here. And then we have our next guest, John Nichols, national affairs writer for The Nation and co-founder of Free Press, also an author and speaker. And Heather Hurlboat. I'm going to say that wrong. Hurlboat? Okay. We have Heather, the director, it's okay, nobody that doesn't know me tries to say my last name either, director of New Bottles of Policy Change and New America, a speaker and obviously formerly served in the Clinton administration in way too many impressive roles for me to name without taking too much time. So all of these people I could have said a lot more about, but I really want to yield the time to them. So you guys know how this is going to work. They're each going to say a little something about themselves, why they're here, and about the topic. And then we're going to engage in a conversation with the panel. And by we, I mean we. And then in the last section, the last about 25 minutes of the program, will be dedicated to looking at these questions that you guys have given and engaging directly with the panel. So with that said, let us start, Marshall, with you, please.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here. I'm very happy to be talking about this very important subject, even though I'm not a political person by training. I'm an economist. I've been working as an economist for a couple of years in Washington, D.C., and what I want to talk to you about is sort of the issues of the Democratic Party as I've encountered at working as essentially a Democratic-friendly, though not in the party, policy professional in the D.C. environment. So the first thing that I want to say is that politics is an ideological struggle for power. That is a very controversial statement, and it's an uncomfortable one for a lot of people, and it's an especially uncomfortable one for the Democratic Party as I see it in the current environment. I think that the party as a whole would rather look at politics as an attempt to influence the public, influence the political system, to enact the policy preferences, the policy recommendations of a set of experts whom they have deemed to be the ones who should set policy for the rest of the country. And I think that that fundamental dichotomy between what politics is and the way that the Democratic Party considers politics and tries to operate within it is at the root of a lot of its recent issues in actually winning elections and influencing policy for the better. So let me mention a few reasons why that dichotomy doesn't work for the party. For one thing, it fails to apprehend the extent to which expert opinion has been discredited by recent events in the public mind. I think that the Great Recession being the obvious example of a major policy failure that shouldn't have happened in the first place. It happened because of misguided economic policies, and the recovery from it has been anything has been well short of what it should have been as a result of a linked but separate set of policy failures. And you know, consequently, we've had many years, in some cases, many decades of economic outcomes that just haven't worked out for individual people, and they view themselves correctly as having been essentially screwed over by the political system. So in an environment in which the establishment has been discredited by failed policies, that's going to give rise to the a strength of outsiders and people wanting to hear from voices that would otherwise have been outside the pale in a previous era. And I think the Democratic Party has sort of clung to the life raft, what it sees as the life raft of respectability and the elite establishment, even as the public has left it in one direction or another.
I'm sorry, really quick, Marshall. Sorry to interrupt. Guys, apparently we have such a big crowd that we are broadcasting outside, so speaking into the mic this closely is actually important to engage all people here. So sorry to ask. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you very much. In some sense, experts are their own interest, and I think that we can see that. I see that most closely in the realm of economic policy, where the people who are allowed to have an opinion about economic policy are credentialed in the same way and generally come from the same set of institutions and certainly don't look like the public as a whole. And then essentially the party kind of functions as a way of trying to tell the people who would affiliate with the Democratic Party, you know, many, many tens of millions of people in the United States, that the opinions of these experts who don't look anything like them are the ones that they should rally behind. And I think that that has been a tough sell for the party elites, in the last round of presidential elections, and then just looking across the country at the extent of the sort of geographical crisis that that faces the party on down ballot through the Obama years. I also want to stress the problem that arises from the failure of outside sources of funding that would once have challenged the kind of wealthy interests and the billionaires that are now the main source of funding, not just for the elections, because as we've seen, you don't need to rely exclusively on the billionaires to fund a political campaign once every 2 years or once every 4 years, but to build up the party infrastructure, so the think tanks and the outside organizations where people tend to work when they're out of power, those used to be funded by a wide array of organizations that to some degree were answerable to the public and aggregated interest from the ground up. And they are now largely financed by, you know, a essentially elite coterie. And it's not so much that those people are malicious or malevolent in their desires for public policy, but they are not representative of the public. So an institution that's organized in that way is going to be very unlikely to apprehend a shifting opinion in the general public in favor of, you know, the opinion that is expressed at fundraisers and that sort of thing. I think that I often think back to, you know, formative experience of my political life, which was the lead up to the Iraq War. I was an undergraduate at the time, and, you know, I thought that as a foreign policy it was a bad idea, and that, you know, certainly divided the Democratic Party basically right down the middle, or maybe not right down the middle, but it certainly divided the Washington Democratic Party right down the middle. And there was I don't know how well people remember the sort of months leading up to the war, there was this foray by the UN to project weapons inspectors into Iraq to see whether Saddam really did or did not have weapons of mass destruction. And it kind of ended up all riding on the report of this one guy, Hans Blix, a former civil servant from Sweden, who was delivering a report to the Security Council and was going to say whether he did or did not find weapons of mass destruction. And the Democratic Party kind of was very obvious at the time, was essentially hoping that the Swedish guy would bail them out of their political problem, that he would solve the crisis of politics by essentially decreeing from on high what the right Iraq policy would be, and that would save everyone in Congress from the possibility of dangerous primary challenges, and, you know, everyone who wanted to run for president would be bailed out because they could kind of hide behind this elite validator, this third-party expert kind of thing. And it was such bad politics that really kind of galvanized me to think, you know, this is not the way you run a political party, and I think that appealing to outside validators is a big problem even now, where you see a lot of people want, like, the CIA or the press to kind of resist Trump from within. I mean, in the case of the CIA or the press, is going to solve the Russia problem by kind of coming in from the outside, and so that's going to make it so that actual political people don't have to do politics anymore, because they'll be bailed out by the equivalent of Hans Blix in another context. So,
oh dear! And on that pleasant note, quick wrap up, would you? Yeah, thank you.
I'll stop there. I think I've made my point.
We will get a chance to come back to that. I promise you. Okay.
Right. So,
where we go?
Which one of these five people are unlike the other and is kind of odd up here? That would be me. I assume that they wanted the audience represented up on this panel, since politics isn't my profession.
Sorry, can you do me a favor? Yes, I know
it's not my profession, nor am I as competent as inarticulate as these guys. But I will try to share some initial thoughts. First, I'd like to know, how many of you really asked that question, who is the Democratic Party today? Raise your hand. Okay. How many of you feel really certain you know who the Democratic Party is today? Okay. Good. I think the last election is telling us that we're not sure, and that we need to ask. I can't help but be a glasses half full kind of guy. And as I was telling Heather a little bit ago, I work with startup companies, larger companies, help run an accelerator, incubator in the high-tech startup world, and we have a lot of companies involved in ours. And we look at lean times as opportunities to reassess what's going on, what we've done right, what we've done wrong, and then move forward. The problem is that during that time, you could lose it all. And I think America's in the same place. You know, it's a very scary time. The stakes are higher than anything we've experienced in my lifetime, except I was barely born during the Cuban Missile Crisis. It is time to say, how did we leave so many people behind? How did so many working class Americans feel disenfranchised from a party who would suggest that we have their backs? You know, so the friends and I had gathered on the night of the election and had stocked up on a lot of champagne. And I had even brought my pajamas over, and my husband's going, what are you doing? I said, well, I'm going to stay there and celebrate all night. So, you know, should have knocked on wood. We with our tails between our legs, took off about 10:30, went home. I stayed up till about 12:30 and went to bed. And when I woke up at 4 and went to my PDA, I saw that Hillary had conceded. So immediately my first reaction was just a pit in the stomach. But the next reaction was being so embarrassed. I mean, embarrassed, and it shook my core that I had not even imagined what the other side was going to feel. That I was ready to celebrate knowing that 50% of America was going to feel as bad as I felt right then. And I knew that I helped lose the election for that reason. You can't become so tribal. We can't become so tribal that we're willing to allow 50% of our fellow citizens to celebrate when 50% of our fellow citizens are going to feel desperate. You know, the what you're reading is not only have we become tribal, not only do we believe the other candidate is bad for this country, but we believe their supporters will do damage to this country. The divisions, and John and the other people up here can speak to this much better than I can, but you know, I guess we've just grown, we've had 30 years of pretty softball politics up until the Clinton years. And if you look back historically, it was full on beforehand, before the 70s. So I think the opportunity is really a lot of introspection, is reassessment of our core values, is rearticulation of our vision and our mission as a people. And hopefully that will be more inclusive. It's not demonizing, and social media just does it. I mean, not, you know, we're conditioned, and certainly my friends who include some of the top political operatives, they know how to get you to vote. You know, they know what part of the cerebral cortex to engage, and if they can build up fear multiple times, they can write you off. You're going to go vote, and you're going to go vote for them. So that's how they do it. You know, I would, if that wasn't exactly what they were hired for, I'd be more pissed off about it. But the aftermath is pretty destructive. I left the Obama campaign. I was a fundraiser and subsequently became chair of his LGBT council, leadership council at the end of 11. And, you know, I've never said it in a room this size. The real reason I left, the public reason I left is because I left to start a new NPR station in Midland, Odessa, Texas, where I thought they really desperately needed one. And you know, it was about the need for us to model fact-based conversation and civil discourse. And the challenge was getting people from Midland, Odessa, Texas to fund this new NPR station. So, I mean, they're all Republicans. And I started with the greatest challenge. I thought if I could get Jim Henry of Henry Oil to help me fund and start this. He was George Herbert Walker Bush's very best friend, or still is. And he
Eugene,
would not.
I love okay. this story, but.
Good.
Story. No, I'm not cutting you off. I just want to, I want to, before you get to the crux of the story, I want you to know that this, that, get to the crux of the story.
Okay. I mean, the thing is, as I told him is, you know, when he didn't want to meet, is if you're not more scared than I am, that the greatest threat to America is that you and I can't talk versus who's president of this country, then we have nothing to talk about. And when we talked, we agreed we had values in common. We just had different tactics of that. So I think we have to go back and talk about values. My husband and I have started a book club off Facebook in Austin where we encourage people to read three books, Hillbilly Elegies, Strangers in Their Own Land, and Politics of Resentment. And it's very hard when everybody gets together. We've had a seminary get together. We have people from the university, and we've had just political friends. You know, it's meant to excite empathy, and I think that's kind of a first step. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you, Eugene.
Brothers and sisters.
Oh, boy.
I hate that the Democratic Party doesn't have a sense of what it is and doesn't have a sense of how to even refer to one another. It's a tragedy, and we'll talk about that a little bit. Of course, we should greet ourselves as brothers and sisters, or in some other way. Although, I admit up front, I'm a liar. I'm the outlier on this panel for a variety of reasons. But I am my great-grandfather's great-grandson. And my great-grandfather, who grew up and lived in Blue River, Wisconsin, population 300, was, as a young man, a Republican and a passionate, committed Republican. He grew up amid veterans of the Civil War, and he believed the Republican Party was founded to end the original sin of the American experiment, slavery. And he could not stand the thought of being in the room with a Democrat, because Democrats had been on the wrong side of so many of those struggles. As a young man, he engaged with Robert M. La Follette and became a progressive. He was active in the Wisconsin Progressive Party after leaving the Republican Party. And then, as an older man in his last years, he became a Democrat. But he said strongly that nothing about me changed in those 50-some years. I have no respect for the Democratic Party. I have no respect for the Progressive Party. I have no respect for the Republican Party. I have respect for a set of values that believes that discrimination and racism is wrong, that believes that our economics should be centered around working people, farmers and factory workers and small business owners, not the wealthy, and that when it comes time to decide whether to have a war, our default position should be to try to avoid the damn thing rather than to rush into it. And I don't want too much buzz, but I'm going to get whipped by my moderator here. But I didn't
bring the actual whip.
Well, that's whipping is a political term, my friend.
Just keep.
I had not thought in that other direction, but it's exotic, and I know we're in Boulder. I hold to the view that, and so I say this up front because I've got no great investment with any political party. What my investment is with those set of values. And like my great-grandfather, we'll plant where we'll put our flag where we can find it at that point. And I bring that up front because I think this is an important thing to understand. There is no way to have a rational discussion about the Democratic Party at this point because the Democratic Party is radically different things in different places and to different people. And what we might get to in this conversation is some sort of sense of how it could be more defined and what it might be. But I travel this country, and I would venture to talk to as many Democrats as anybody you'll imagine, and just about as many Republicans. When I've been in Alabama, this is my favorite line from Alabama. People say, you know, down in Alabama, folks are afraid to come out of the closet as lesbian or gay for fear that they might be thought to be Democrats. Now, on the other hand, I've been in sub-precincts of Vermont where people are afraid to come out as a Democrat for fear that they will be thought to be reactionaries. And so this is the complexity of our nation. And there are people in rural areas in this country who go out and put up a Democratic sign, put up a Hillary Clinton sign, and they feel they're taking a risk, that they are doing a bold, radical gesture. And there are people in big cities in this country who think that, you know, they can't bring themselves to even think of mentioning Hillary Clinton because they think, well, she's so compromised, she's just not anywhere near where I'm at. And these are people all trying to be in this same thing. So here's where, to my mind, the crisis of the Democratic Party is today. And the crisis, I think, began quite a while ago, and it was a failure to define itself. And what the Democratic Party has done, in my opinion, over the last 40 years, too often, has been to define itself as not the other guys, right? Not those guys. And so whole campaigns have been run on saying, well, I'm not as bad as Donald Trump, or I'm not as bad as George Bush, so vote for me. And that is that at the end of the day, in a period of radical change, becomes the worst possible message. The single worst possible message is I'm not as bad as the other guy. Because if things get bad enough, people are going to say, well, yeah, the other guy's bad, but you know, at least it's something. And I'm not kidding. Something, people go for something. When you're down in the hole and somebody's putting it, if they're leaning a stick down, that's great, that'll pull you up. But if they lean a snake down, you're still going to maybe try and grab because it might be how to get out of the hole. And so we have, now that's a rural reference. But all I want to tell you is this is an important thing. This is an important thing to understand. The Democratic Party, by and large, has no literature. You're trying to get people to read some things. It has a very limited sense of itself as a, you know, where it's at. Is it social democratic? Is it, you know, business friendly, centrist? And that's got to change. And the way that you change it is by taking risks and being something rather than just saying we're not the other guys. At this point, in my opinion, the Democratic Party, by and large in America, is a managerial party. It says, give us power, and we'll manage the mess really well. And the Republican Party is a revolutionary party. They say, give us power, and we'll change everything. Now, they're lying, as you see, right? But in politics, I know it's going to be a shock to you, but people lie.
Careful, whip's coming out.
I know, but let me close it off with this good concept for you. We are 30 years into a globalization revolution that has changed everything about how we relate to the rest of the world, for good and ill. We are 20 years into a digital revolution that has changed everything about how we communicate, for good and bad. We're 8 to 10 years into an automation revolution that is and will change everything about how we work. Donald Trump knew that, and he said, I'm going to make you great again. I'm going to take you back to something. It was an absurd construct. The Democratic Party, instead of saying, that's absurd, here's what's happening to you. This is why you feel nervous. This is why you feel tense. This is why you feel overwhelmed, said, well, we won't be Trump. And the fact of the matter is, if you say, I'm going to take you back to something, even if it's impossible, that is better than somebody saying, I'm not that guy. And so for Democrats, they had better wrap their head around the 21st century and where this country is going. Because if you do, you will find radical, not soft centrist, radical solutions that will excite generations of young people and that will transform our politics. Don't be managerial, be change agents.
Thank you.
Well, I want to start by thanking the CWA for putting me on this panel, because I have spent the last 15 years of my life working on the intersection between progressive or liberal politics and national security policy. And it is incredibly rare to have it suggested that someone who comes from an international affairs background has anything to say about democratic politics. So thank you. And maybe that's why I've decided to totally get rid of my usual CWA personality and be the raving optimist on this panel. So I apologize to folks who came hoping to hear me say something depressing. Because I think I would start from the other end that maybe some of my fellow panelists have. And I would say right now, who we are as Democrats is hopping mad and not taking it anymore. And, you know, if you look at what happened in Kansas earlier this week, if you look at the Ossoff race, if you look Montana, guys, we're contending in Montana. Where I live, if you look at the explosion of really interesting candidates for the gubernatorial race in Virginia, where we've got two great choices, and we can have a vicious fight about which one of them you like, but they're two great choices. We're going to have my state of Maryland, where we inattentively got ourselves a Republican governor the last in between presidential election. We're going to have some great candidates next time around. And you are seeing all over the country people going into politics, people going out and doing stuff. And I'll make two comments about who those are. And with apologies to my friend from The Nation, I'm going to recommend an article that was published in The Prospect last week. Okay,
yeah,
good. No schisms up here. No. Pointing out who are the people who are on the ground out there in the streets doing the organizing, doing the campaigning. You know, in other words, who are the new shock troops on the ground of the Democratic Party? Because if, as we heard, we're a populist movement, we're going to take back populism, we're going to be a people-first movement. So who are those people? Number one, they're women. So future of the Democratic Party looks very female. And that raises some challenges, which we'll talk about in a minute. But number two, They are not fighting on the ground about whether they're liberals or whether they're progressives. They are managing not to have entire meetings disintegrate into screaming fights about whether Bernie should have won the primary or whether Joe Biden should have won. They are somehow managing to use the dreaded intersectionality and actually get things done at the grassroots. And that should give all of us who are professional Democrats or professional progressives, as all of us on this panel are to one degree or another. Gene, you know, you can try to leave the party, but the party always finds you. And that should both give us a big sense of optimism, and it should give us a big kick in the butt to get out of the way. And keep our fights and our disagreements and our 30 years of anger with the guy who didn't understand me right when I had a better platform than he did back in, you know, 1984. And I just need to get out of the way and, you know, as you said, let the party be remade by the folks with the energy from the ground up. So that would be my first point. My second point is, there's this little issue of gender that we have. And there's also this little issue of race that we have. And John, you touched on it briefly, but I've got an almost unbroken record since last summer of going to panels about electoral politics in this country, and we don't talk about gender and race. And we as Democrats, it has to be possible both to talk about the very real economic issues that our country is facing and the very real sense of economic alienation that our fellow citizens of all genders and races feel, and also recognize that we are facing, and this is something that I think unites anybody who wants to come hang out on our side of the aisle, we are also facing a group of people who just have got very activated in their brains that it's scary when people who don't look like white guys are claiming a share of power. And to go back to Marshall's comment at the very beginning of his remarks, politics is a struggle for power. It's not nice and cuddly, and sometimes you can grow the pie, and sometimes you can't. And some people getting more power results in at least the perception of other people getting less power. And we dealt with that in the elections. It turns out we were dealing with that for 8 years under the presidency of Barack Obama, and we didn't understand it. I strongly suspect that people of color could have told us, if we'd listened a little more carefully, that we were going to face a backlash against the first African-American president that was going to be visited on the first female presidential nominee. And we didn't see that. We also didn't see, and here I'll segue to my third point, we also didn't see how those fears over race and gender and otherness and power linked together with a set of security fears. Who remembers, you all experienced this here in Colorado in 2014, those incredibly embarrassing, stupid ads about how Hezbollah fighters infected with Ebola were going to be sent here by ISIS to kill us in our shopping malls? Yeah, we laughed. Your professional political class laughed, and we said, your professional national security elites, of which I am definitely one, laughed and said, those are so stupid, we don't need to bother to respond to those because they're so stupid and everyone understands that. Well, turns out women voters in particular, people say, why did women voters vote for Donald Trump? Why do married white women continue to vote? Kellyanne Conway is an underestimated genius, and she worked hard 4 years. Imagine how hard it was for her to convince the Republican Party that this was worth doing, by the way. That's how much of an underestimated genius she is. To convince women that there are things to be so scared of, and the Democrats aren't even talking about those things. So you've got to vote for the Republican, even if he is a horrible sexist pig. So we, as a party, as much as many of us came to our progressive politics from the anti-war route that was described earlier, we've got to combine our economic message, our message about not just inclusion, but full empowerment for traditionally disenfranchised groups. And we've got to address people's fears, however ridiculous they seem and however ridiculous they in fact are. We've got to go where that fear actually is, rather than just say, you know, never mind, let me tell you about reproductive choice and free college. Those would be my 3 points of where we got to go with all this wonderful energy and reason for hope. that you should be feeling right now.
Are we lucky or what? So with that in mind, we had actually brainstormed. We only have a few minutes together before these things, but we brainstormed a little bit about some things to talk about during the section where the panel, you know, gets engaged with each other. But I got to say, I'm going to change my mind a little bit. Because your conversation really brought some things to the fore that I think that I think we really need to address in this particular group. Before I do that, how many Democrats are in this audience? I mean, seriously, but how many Republicans? See, hey, thank you. Thank you for joining the conversation. I knew it would be a little bit like that, but I thought maybe we'd have a few more. But frankly, that also is going to help me, guide the questions. I think that a thing that came up in every single person's conversation up here was the word values. What values are we, and obviously I'm speaking from the point of view of a Democrat, a member of the party, you can call me establishment if you'd like. What are the values that we as Democrats are projecting, if any? I know there's obviously argument around that, but what would you maybe suggest to, if you had the, if Tom Perez were sitting in this audience right now or other people that have some power to imbue some of this into action, and there are some people in this room I know that do, what would you, starting with Marshall, be some of the suggestions you'd give, and then you guys just start going, but I'm willing to cut you off if y'all get crazy, so.
Yeah, so I would definitely start by saying we need to reclaim the values of populism. This has been, I think, really savagely tarred, certainly by Donald Trump, but even by, I would say, a false history of the actual, capital P populist movement that happened in this country in the 1890s, where that is viewed with, I'm thinking specifically of a book that Richard Hofstadter, the sort of leading kind of center-left historian of the establishment in the 1950s and 60s, basically wrote about them as proto-Nazis and said that they were the precursors of McCarthy, that they were anti-immigrant and anti-Semitic. And I feel like that kind of set the stage for divide that I think Heather was sort of alluding to in her remarks, that says, we have values that are about, we have an economic agenda, and then we also have a racially inclusive agenda and a gender inclusive agenda, and that these things are considered to be at odds. That is a false history of the capital P populist movement, and that is a false projection for what could be a general value of populism in politics going forward. I mentioned in my opening statement that it's a problem that the funding sources for the Democratic Party and its kind of affiliated institutions have moved from away from labor unions and from outside groups that could be seen as more representative towards the elite. That has a profound impact on the sorts of ideas that get put forward. And I think that if we, want to, I worry in my future looking forward, it's not like labor unions are going to start dramatically funding, economics research anytime soon. We're grateful for what they've already done, and they do, and for what little resources they have, they do very good work. But the fundamental issue is that our values are anti-hierarchical, but our institutions are necessarily hierarchical for that that reason of funding. And that, the Republicans have their billionaire-funded, the Koch brothers, whatever, institutions, and that's perfectly fine. That works extremely well for them because it is completely consistent with the way they think society should work, that is, billionaires telling everyone what to do. That is not what we see as a good life. That is not what we put forward before the voters, I should hope. And it's going to be very hard for us to make the case for populism in public with a coherent agenda that I think, I hope, and as Heather mentioned, that kind of starts from the ground up and listens to the fact that there are a lot of people out there who are really mad and deserve to be listened to and not talked down to from an elite that has not a terribly good political track record.
And Heather, since you were in vote?
Well, Well, I was going to tease Marshall a little bit and say, if you think labor unions aren't hierarchical, you haven't spent a lot of time around labor unions. But you asked us about values, and I think the one I'd start with is dignity, actually. And, you know, this, I think, covers a whole bunch of things, because you clearly saw people, you know, feeling that the way that Trump paid attention to their communities returned a sense of dignity to them. And, you know, to Jean's point about how difficult it is for us to talk civilly to each other, you know, dignity seems like a place where perhaps we can come to understand each other. And how, you know, for example, my concern about whether Betsy DeVos will honor the commitment to get my special needs child educated just like any other child, how that's a point of dignity for me and for my family. And how, you know, not getting endlessly stopped and frisked for driving while black is a point of dignity for people of color. And that's a construct that's really core to all of us, and that I think does sort of combine a number of items of the agenda. And just because, as I said, I'm a security policy geek, we have to do a better job of saying we're the party that doesn't just want to run charging into the world and shoot guns at things, and we're the party that's not naive. And I think actually we are being presented with this golden opportunity where, and by the way, this just... the other party, let's not forget that the other party is in at least as bad shape. And all of the descriptors, John, that you gave, I was sitting here thinking those could apply to both parties.
I'll give you one that doesn't.
And we have the moment as our message to say we're the people who are strong and sane. And if you think that I'm deliberately choosing words that can be filled somewhat differently for different sectors of our party, I am. Because, you know what, the U.S., for better or worse, I think we are stuck with a two-party system for the foreseeable future, and others on the panel may disagree. But as long as we have a two-party system, we are going to have two big tent coalitional parties. And in a two-party system, you want to have a coalition of people who don't all agree with each other on everything, because otherwise you're never going to be a majority party. So our challenge, I think, is less to define we are only these things, and more to define how can we be a set of things that appeal to this many people rather than just this many.
And... Let me take a shot. But Eugene was invoked, so you're definitely next.
Go. Up
to you guys. Go for
it. I missed your invocation, bro.
So I want to start with listening. You know, instead of us saying what the core values are, I think people in America want to be listened to, heard, and understood. My friend Matthew Barzin, who had been the ambassador to Sweden and most recently was the ambassador to the Court of St. James, I was with him in December, and we were anticipating... It was after the election. He said, what we need to do, so I don't know if you guys realize, but around America, we just had an incredible cohort of ambassadors who really spread out through those countries and did great work for us. They got to know the countries, and they got to express America by articulation of the values that they saw that we represented, and they did very good work for us. And Matthew was saying, why aren't we doing at least as much in our own country? He goes, let's recruit 50 of the best ambassadors from both our administration and some previous Republican administrations, set them in states, and have them really listen to Americans to find out what we want, what we need, and how we articulate that. So I'm a huge fan of Matthew's project. And then I was very thrilled to hear of course, Barack Obama would declare that he's only 55 and being president cannot be the apex of his professional career. So he's looking to do something bigger and better. And through the administration, he and David Seamus are talking about putting together, I wouldn't call it listening, but more of a grassroots outreach initiative to re-engage Americans so that they feel empowered in the structure. I am hoping that that will be done in a bipartisan manner with maybe the Bush School that's out of A&M, which is doing some really good bipartisan work.
I think this is a great moment to mention in connection to that the Tom Perez, Bernie Sanders listening tours of red states, which I think is a terrific initiative exactly along those lines, although not bipartisan, but certainly bringing together the wings of the party in a really encouraging way.
I'm probably not more than a day or so goes by where I'm not invited to come and talk to a county Democratic Party someplace. And I say to them, and I've been invited to a few Republican, Libertarian, and others, but I'll say to the Democrats, you know, I'm a pretty tough critic of the Democratic Party as it operates today. I'm harsh on it. And they say, well, that's why we're inviting you. Because, you know, this thing of getting out of the way, I so agree with. The leadership of the Democratic Party, its disregard for the base is often so scorching, so startling, that people who literally do the hard work, who climb up on the side of a barn to put a sign on it, who, you know, walk through a tough, sometimes even a dangerous neighborhood to drop lit, I mean, they do not feel a connection to the top of this party. I cannot begin to tell you how scorching that is. And I want to also emphasize that, I want to change two words here. We're talking about values. I rarely go any place where I meet a bunch of Democrats where they don't have very shared values. They just don't think those values are reflected at the top of their party. And so I would suggest that rather than the word values, it's confidence. And the Democratic Party is a party that lacks confidence. It is a party that talks about intersectionality, and often very, very well, and I think really respects the concept, and yet does not always confidently say that Muslim Americans are our brothers and our sisters, and I will stand in solidarity with them against Donald Trump and anyone else at every turn. Because Heather's exactly right. The reason that Donald Trump went to Minnesota the weekend before the election was literally to repeat that ad. I mean, what she's talking about is so unimaginably true. It's the heart of it. And yet I don't hear this ad about, you know, saying somebody's coming to your shopping mall to kill you or whatever. What I don't hear is that confidence. So values, yeah, but when you get those values, talk about them in a way that leaves no middle ground. I slightly differ on the words. I think you've got to stand for something in this moment, because we're in a moment of such radical and constant communication that if you don't rise above it, your soft language falls below it. And then the other thing is this word listening, which sounds great. And I'm down with listening, although my mother said I wasn't as good at it as I should have been. I'm going to use another word, knowing, right? Because the biggest insult you can give to a rural American, I grew up in a town of 900. Biggest insult you can give to a rural American is to say, I came to listen to you, right? Because they know full well you just drove in to hear what they need to know to get you to vote for them, and then they're heading out, right? No, we need, if this Democratic Party is going to change to become what it needs to be, it has to know people. It has to know them on the ground and understand it. And if the Democratic Party knew America, at this moment, in this resistance moment, they would have, in that final weekend, this last weekend, poured resources into the 4th Congressional District of Kansas, where a progressive Democrat was running a remarkable campaign and brought it to within seven, took a 33-point difference and brought it down to about 7 points, with no money and no support, begging people in Washington, where is the cavalry? When will you come? We put the fight on the ground. Where are you? They didn't come. They got embarrassed finally by an article in Politico, not anything from the base. And they said, oh, well, we threw some calls on in the last day. It was shameful. When someone raises their head above the battlements and says, I'm ready to take the shots, and goes out and takes this resistance moment into the fight and gives you the potential to take a seat held by Donald Trump's head of the CIA and shift it over to the other party, you don't say, oh, well, you know what they actually said? I couldn't believe this. They said, they were like, people say, well, you know, if we'd gone in, we would have shifted the thing. You know, people would have seen the Democrats were in, and then it would have killed the deal. We had to fly under radar. Well, you know what happened? The Republicans recognized, they detected that James Thompson was getting close to winning. And so Paul Ryan sent an urgent message. Mike Pence did robocalls. Donald Trump tweeted about it. They sent Ted Cruz into the district. They poured hundreds of thousands of dollars into that district at that last moment. Had the Democrats known what's going on in America today, they would have responded and they would have won that seat and transformed the whole of our political discussion.
Laura, let me say something.
Yeah, go ahead. Absolutely.
And John brought up about leadership. Now, when I look at the party and elections from a perspective, a business perspective, I think, okay, from the business perspective, what happens? And you see a lot of absent CEOs. So the candidates are just being pointed. They're point and click, and they're not running the campaign. Let me tell you, Barack Obama ran the damn campaign. He was in charge. He kept the values, the vision, the mission at the forefront. We have tacticians who, they're very, very good. But, you know, what they do is they need 50 plus one votes, and that's what they go for. It's not a motivating tactic, and it leaves a lot of dead bodies behind. Candidates cannot abdicate their responsibility as CEOs of their own campaigns, nor of the political parties, the organizations that we create as part of the party.
So I guess a thing that concerns me when the discussion takes off in this direction, as it often does, is, okay, fine, Kansas is now over. What's the lesson we learned from Kansas? And what is it that everybody in this room can be doing, not just to make sure that John Ossoff gets everything he needs to have his best shot at going over 50% next Tuesday? By the way, can I just say how much fun it is to be on a panel that I can actually just be a Democrat? I'm really enjoying this at that level. But, you know, that Montana race, to make sure that the Montana race gets treated like Ossoff and not like Kansas. And what are we sure that when we have the kind of conversation, the kind of aftermath autopsy conversation, are we sure that we're having it in a way that encourages people to get in rather than discouraging people? Are we sure that we're having it in a way that communicates to candidates, hey, you've got to be in charge? The consultants are going to come and tell you, oh, we'll do this, we'll do that. Are we sure that we're communicating, hey, here's the right way to do it. Here's the sort of, you know, maybe you don't think you can be Barack Obama when you're running for school board, but here's the example of how you can do your job. What are we all doing, all of us who, you know, whether it's we're in our local party committee, whether we're commentators on the national level, are we sure that we're getting out positive lessons about the future and not doing that thing that we on the left love to do, which is spending all our time criticizing each other and knocking each other down? So, you know, sort of what are the three things we want to see the party do in every race? What are the three things that we want to see every candidate? Because, Gene, I totally agree with your point about candidates need to do their own thing, and I don't think they get told that. So what are the three things that we want to use our channels in the miracle of this wonderful, diffuse party that has its organs, and then it has all of us who are also in our own way a party organ? What are the things that we want to do to get these messages
out? Let's not confuse our roles, though, Heather. I mean, we're not here as consultants to solve the party's issues right now. We're here to talk about where the party is, what the good and the bad is about it. Look, you know, we just elected, when I was on the president's campaign, and particularly in the LGBT arena, I was very proactive. What will work? You know, when we just elected my friend Steve Adler to mayor of Austin, you know, and I was helping run his campaign, of course I was talking about what could work and what would motivate. I mean, we're up here to talk honestly about what the problems are, and is the Democratic Party working? So I agree there's a time to be constructive. I don't feel compelled for that until we get it out, until we air the dirty laundry.
Let me just come on also and say I'm not here as a consultant or even a commentator. I'm here as a physician.
As a what?
A physician.
I literally cannot.
A doctor. You know, that's like a guy
that
say, you know, when you get sick.
I couldn't tell if he was saying physician or physician. And with you,
I'm
it could be either one.
I'm here as a physician. Okay. And unfortunately, now I know women are better than men. in every way. But I will tell you this. You know, women usually, if a doctor tells them there's a problem, they tend to take it rather seriously. Guys are terrible. They'll say, you know, what you're eating, the stuff you're doing, you're likely to die. And the guy will say, well, likely was the operative word there. You know. And so I, as a physician, I want to examine the Democratic Party and tell you that it's like it's acting like a guy. It's not taking counsel. It's not taking it's not looking at what's going on and taking it in. So I can't be soft with it. I don't think it's healthy for this body to die. And so this party has had a stunningly awful couple cycles. It's a disaster out there at the legislative level, at the congressional level, at the presidential level. And so there are real things that the party has to do. And I would say this to Republicans as well. In fact, I've spoken to Republican groups where I've said their internal crisis. I warned the Republican Party before Donald Trump came that Donald Trump was coming. And what I would always say to them is, you people have created a false construct. You have a group of rich people at the top who then create messaging for working class people and get their votes and then govern entirely as rich people, right? And eventually somebody's going to come along like Donald Trump, say to the working class, the base of the party, you know, those rich guys aren't really looking out for you. And even as a billionaire, they're going to believe him, and he's going to do it. And he did. The problem of the Democratic Party, in my opinion, and different people, wonderful, brighter people than I is, well, in my opinion, the Democratic Party doesn't take intersectionality seriously enough. It doesn't move that word to the next word, which is solidarity, which is that you stand absolutely firmly on behalf of the people who have committed themselves to you as their last hope, and that solidarity cannot merely be on a basis of religious diversity, gender, sexuality, race, all vital things, but it also must be regional. There are rural folks out in America who would be Democrats but just never even hear that the party has an interest in them. There are urban folks of many, many races. There are Native Americans every Native American activist I've talked to has said to me, there was one candidate who came to our reservations. There was one candidate who actually did listen and then fully incorporated what we were saying into his messages to a point where he took it into the platform, and he ultimately, even after the election, was out there in front of the White House delivering that message. They said, that was Bernie Sanders. And the fact of the matter is, I think that this party still wrestles with the reality of the Bernie Sanders candidacy. Whether they like it or not, Bernie Sanders challenged this party as an independent who sits as a Democrat and said, look, you people have to be something fundamentally different. And I believe there is still a deep internal wrestling match. And rather than, you know, saying, you know, you don't have to deal with this right away, but maybe you should start exercising and eating well, I would say to the Democratic Party, you really, really do need to get, not Bernie Sanders, he'll come out on the listening tour, you need to get why Bernie Sanders was getting 82% of the votes of people under 30 across all classes, across all races.
Well, Bernie Sanders certainly won Boulder.
Well, he did, yeah. But he also, do you know what else? He won every competitive rural county in the country.
Yeah. No disagreement there, and I think there's some good points there, and I know Marshall wants to jump in. I want to, as you jump in, Marshall, and hopefully you can incorporate this, we've got a lot of questions. What I'm trying to do is, and some really, really awesome questions. I'm going to consolidate them and prioritize students. Money and politics. Can you incorporate that into this conversation that you're about to rebut? Okay. Go for it.
So I just want to give a concrete example of where I see an upcoming cleavage in the party that speaks to what both John and Heather were just saying, and I think speaks to what this whole panel has been about. It's very clear that in the Trump administration, immigrants and Muslims and people who are undocumented are being victimized by the federal government. And this is our base. And in particular, the Bureau of Immigration and Customs Enforcement is going into churches. They're making it impossible for victims of domestic violence to appear in court against their abusers for fear of being deported. This is that could not be a more intersectional issue. And when we run another national campaign, we need to be telling our people that we will protect them from this malevolent force that is making it impossible to live their lives. And I foresee that that proposition is going to be a lot more controversial than high-level calls for intersectionality, because taking on an entrenched federal bureaucracy that we saw with Black Lives Matter that police departments that are seen to be victimizing their own citizens whom they should be protecting get a lot of political support. This is not a walk in the park, a cakewalk type of politics. And yet, we need to be telling the people who we're saying we represent, not just you should believe this, but we are here to protect you from the very powerful forces that are oppressing you and that are oppressing you because it's in the political interests of our opposition. So I think, there's, to relate this to money in politics, I think that, that's not a message that, that specifically the Democratic Party is going to stick its neck out to protect vulnerable people who are being victimized by the federal government. That's not going to, pull well, or that's not going to do well at a fundraiser on the Upper East Side or something like that, and it's not going to be what people in Silicon Valley want to hear. I think that if we actually, this is the whole issue: are we a top-down party or a bottom-up party? Politics, as I started out by saying, it's about power. Our people feel that they have been disempowered by the government that's supposed to protect them, that is instead being used as a weapon for the people who would rather see them poor or and evicted and deported. And that if we're not going to listen to that, then there's really no point in us being here.
But we could raise hundreds of millions of dollars online in retail fundraising with those images.
We can do that for a one campaign. Sanders is the obvious example when that's happened recently. But it's been shown that say there's a bunch of ICE raids, that'll definitely galvanize the small dollar donors to give money to a candidate, which is great. But what it won't do is fund a gigantic party infrastructure that we need to do battle with the Republicans and their outside groups who are enormously powerful, and they don't go away. They don't go away when they lose elections. They bring the billionaires back together and they give another round of hundreds of billions of dollars. And that's where the small dollar donors, at least historically, have not. It's a little hard to ask small dollar donors to say can you please pay the salary of this economist guy? Why would they do that? They don't. In fact, they shouldn't even be asked.
And I'm just really quick. I want you to work one other question because I'm getting lots of questions, and I think Eugene, you could do this. You brought two things, so now we've got money in politics. So we're answering a bunch of questions. Awesome. Mm-hmm. I'm going to challenge the panel to bring another topic in. Yeah, this is a really good one. How much of the Democratic weaknesses are related to poor messaging and communications? Several of those, saying.
So, those are totally connected. We have achieved full connection here, because the reason the Democratic Party's messaging is so horrible is money in politics. Simple as that. The reason our politics is so horrible, and messaging and all of it, is money in politics. Because the reality of money in politics, everybody thinks money in politics is about getting money to win an election. Only the dumb people give money, and I don't mean the small donors. I love the small donors, but I'm talking the dumb rich people, of which there are so many. They give money. They give money. They get talking to give money to win an election. Give money to define the issues up front. You define what the debate is about, and it doesn't matter what the two parties are doing. And so the Koch brothers, we did a book on all this called Dollarocracy. We charted all their money. And you know what we found out? The Koch brothers give a lot more money in non-election years than they do in election years, because they want people to debate about, whether – they want to make it logical in a debate that you would cut food stamps in order to pay for a tax cut for rich people. And if you give enough money, you can actually make that logical. So the fact of the matter is that Democratic messaging has too frequently reflected a donor class desire. Now, one thing I'll differ with Marshall on, I think what Marshall described in some ways, you could actually get some big donors to be supportive of that. So I don't, and small donors. So I want to be cautious here about how people might take some of what I'm saying. My argument is not for the Democratic Party to pit people against each other, rural versus urban, white versus people of color, men versus women, whether we keep the LGBTQ community up front or whether we tell them, oh, yeah, go, why don't you go back to where you were in the past? Give us money. But, yeah, I know it's not. And so, you know, that's not what I'm saying. My problem with the Democratic Party at this point is it doesn't expand the circle. It doesn't push the limits out. And this is where I'll use a good example. If Hillary Clinton had gotten Barack Obama's numbers in rural America in his second race, not his first, she would have won. And she would have won quite well. And yet, when I went to the filed the platform process, I noticed that in the Democratic platform, the draft platform, about messaging, had 42 words about rural issues. 42 words. 42. Now, they expanded it. They got up to about 60 at the, you know. In 1976, the Democratic Party had 1,200 words. And I asked Obama people about this, and they said, well, you know, we had a lot more, obviously, in there. But here's the interesting thing. Barack Obama insisted on going to rural areas. He insisted on talking to rural people. He insisted on communicating with them because he understood that rural America is multiracial, multiethnic. It has more majority-minority counties than urban America. And he recognized that if you had a unified rural message, you could actually win places or at least hold your own. At this point, the donor class, bringing us back to money, the donor class is so urban and so disconnected that the dialogue begins to follow it away from all those people who live too far down the road. And so what I would argue for the Democratic Party is they do have to make a break with the donor class on the messaging issue. And they have to recognize that the voter class of America, this great mass of people, is out there waiting to be talked to. And at core of that message is a very progressive, even radical message about what's happening in the 21st century, about how our lives are changing, and being the coherent force that clearly leads you into and through the next economy that doesn't lie to you. And I promise you, if Democrats begin to do that, they will be amazed at how many people they think wouldn't come near them, wouldn't even consider Democrats, who will say to them, you know, that actually kind of makes sense, and I'm really scared. I'm scared enough to turn to somebody that makes sense, but I won't turn to somebody who doesn't talk to me and only puts 42 words in their platform about my circumstance.
I want to jump in on this and loop back to a point that Marshall's made a couple times. And as someone who spent more than my share of years as a speechwriter for Democratic Party luminaries, we do tend to confuse messaging and communications. And you have a lot of these conversations of, oh, if only Hillary had given a speech about X. Well, no, it's not about anybody giving one more speech about X or having one more campaign message about X. It is about having an arc of communications and even more the substance behind the communications, because if you got nothing good to communicate, you should not be out there talking. But it's what John says about being out there in the off years, about being sure you're, and frankly, this is something that Obama did very badly once he was in office, that he was so controlling that only he could be the messenger, that frankly, we spent 8 years not using as well as we should have the many, many brilliant people who were in his government and should have been allowed to be out all over the country talking up the stuff they were doing a lot more than they were. The other thing that Democrats are terrible at, which Marshall said way back at the beginning, is we have really weak and underfunded ancillary institutions. So, you know, where Republicans have this amazing talk radio culture that people can be immersed in 24/7 if they want, we have wonderful small progressive magazines, which are wonderful, and I love them, and I write for them. You know, where Republicans have Heritage, which is an amazing, huge entity that brings classes of young people to Washington every year. Democrats have Roosevelt on the one hand and Center for American Progress on the other, both of which are awesome, neither of which you could describe as sort of an overwhelming force in American politics. So when we think about communications and messaging, it's really, really not about, if I could just get my candidate to give one speech that mentioned the magic word, whether it's rural or dignity or whatever, it's about having a larger plan to engage in all the ways that the other panelists have described, to engage with the public at multiple levels all the time.
Can I applaud her? And let me throw one line on just to amplify that. The one thing Democrats sort of have, although they don't always welcome them, you know, it's kind of a little bit of a complex relationship, is they do have a documentarian. Michael Moore actually goes out on a regular basis and does, you know, a surprisingly good job. I'm not kidding. But the one thing that the Republicans have, and this is underestimated, they have a literature. And you may say, well, I don't want to read books by Ann Coulter or stuff like that. But do you know that the Republican base gets offered about 100 books every year from prominent luminaries, and they just keep pumping it out? And I don't know if the people read them, but the fact is that they have a lot of people on a regular basis arguing about what the Republican Party should be and who it should be, and they define it in talk radio, but also in this lit. And Steve Bannon, right? Steve Bannon, you know what he did? You know who he wanted to be? He set out to be the Republican Michael Moore. He started making documentaries. And you know what happened with Steve Bannon? He found that he got more documentaries out and was often paid more attention among this base. So my only counsel is that what Heather's saying is so stunningly true, that there has to be more than just, you know, candidates and a party operation. There has to be a literature and a dialogue and something that goes beyond and sometimes accepts, you know, diverse voices to create a party that people are going to actually get excited about.
And also, Eugene, I want you to. So again, I'm challenging my panel to combine because we have 5 more minutes, which is such a shame for those of you that are annoyed with me for trying to keep us on time. But we have to get out at 10:45. Sorry, but what I will say is that this we have several questions that are asking something similar. So if you can also wrap that in to your answer as a challenge to one of the smartest people on the planet. There are a lot of questions here about how Democrats are going to move forward and be more inclusive. And you were one of the people that talked about that. So if you're an independent Republican that is just sick about Trump or et cetera, a lot of those in here, if you want the Democrats to be more inclusive to their original base of labor and the middle class, et cetera, because there's obviously, whether it's true or not, a feeling that that's not what's going on. Suggestions?
I'm going to recall John's story about his granddaddy. You know, it wasn't about party, it was about values and vision. We have got to articulate who we want to be and what we want our country to be, and people will come around to that. I want to add to the, when we're talking about money, you know, let's not forget Sheldon Adelson is going to save $1 billion, you know, in inheritance taxes off of a wealth of $8 billion. So big surprise, he's going to put $100 million into something every now and then. The other side, this is a tangible, hard U.S. dollar ROI on their spend. Their taxes are going to go down. The regulations are going to go down. The profits are going to go up. What would be the payback to us? Well, to rich Americans on the Democratic Party, our taxes are going to go up. So obviously we're motivated by the social return, but it's not as motivating as a financial return. So we're going to have to figure out a retail model. You know, I understand Marshall's, lack of enthusiasm for assuming that the retail model of small donations will fund the apparatus infrastructure that we need. But, you know, nonprofits have figured out how to motivate small dollar donors to give $5 every month, or to give $10 every month, and that's what we're going to have to do for the Democratic infrastructure.
I mean, that would be great, and I think non-political organizations have actually, you know, funded themselves and been very effective in that way. I just wanted to, you know, sort of speak to the issues that have been raised about kind of what to do in the future. I think that, you know, what John was saying is right. Right-wing populism has a very short shelf life because at a fundamental level it doesn't make any sense. It is about motivating, the anger of the voters on behalf of a political agenda that serves an elite. And, you know, the European experience with it really shows that you get these upsurges when the establishment is discredited for some reason, and then they dissipate. And so I think, you know, that is likely to happen. I mean, I hope that is what happens in the United States. But I think that the hate that Donald Trump has shown can be used overtly to motivate voters is not going to go away, nor is the discredit of the elites that gave rise to the conditions under which someone like that could actually win both the Republican nomination and the presidency. And I worry, looking at that, that the Democratic Party will essentially like respond to that as being validating of whatever it does in the meantime, which is to say a very short amount of time. And in particular, I think back to the year of 2004 to 2006, when that was a much stronger Republican administration in the sense that he had, George W. Bush had a united party, and all of the sort of ancillary groups were like definitively behind enacting an agenda. In fact, he was an extremely effective president in terms of getting his agenda through Congress and enacted. The Democrats were so traumatized by that that my diagnosis of what they did in those years was essentially throw everything in the kitchen sink against Bush and you know do whatever it takes. You know, do one strategy to win in this district, another strategy to win in that district. Just stop this administration by any means necessary, which you can understand why they would do that. I'm not saying it was stupid at the time or anything like that, but what it did was kind of postpone the internal discussion of, you know, what is this party actually about until now, because it really wasn't, you know, once you have your own guy in the White House, as we did for 8 years, you know, the premium is on really supporting him, especially when he's, you know, when the administration is so incredibly victimized by an unreasonable opposition that, you know, to be a Democrat is to combat that opposition on behalf of the president that, you know, while we may have some concerns about, we more or less support. So, you know, we're not going to have a big internal debate under those circumstances. So that 2004 to 2006 period, I really feel like was critical and gives us some cautionary tales about what we need to be doing.